This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, that's not historically accurate. The fallacy of fantasy fiction.
Now, I sense, Jules, and I don't know why, but I sense like this is a topic that you're quite excited about.
What gave that away? I've basically put my ranty pants on for this specially, so buckle up, kiddies.
It's opinion time!
It's opinion time. This is obviously opinion that is based in fact. But basically this comes from three different things, the idea for this podcast episode. One of them was a review which I shared with Madeline, which was hilarious, about Madeline Miller's Song of Achilles, and one reviewer had rated it 1 star because of the historical inaccuracy of her making the main characters gay, which was so bloody funny and so ridiculous I genuinely didn't know where to start. So there was that, and that started things ticking over at the back of my mind. And then I read a couple of really good blog posts, which I will mention because I think they're worth people going and checking out. One of them is We Have Always Fought, challenging the women cattle and slaves narrative by Cameron Hurley. That's worth finding. And there's most recently my feminist outcry against historical fantasy by Samantha Shannon, who has just sort of written this massive, massive epic fantasy tome that sort of deconstructs all the standard white cishet male narrative tropes that get used in epic fantasy. So, you know, they've both got things to say. And altogether, it sort of all came together with some research I was doing myself, and I was thinking, fucking hell, there literally is nothing new under heaven, and all the stuff we think is true because everybody thinks so, everybody knows it's like this, is utter bullshit. So, that's where we are.
And I imagine the sad thing is that you know that these people who are exposing, you know, the myths are going to have received a lot of backlash from people who have not done the same level of research and whose entire truth of what history is like all comes from what they've been, you know, ingesting.
Yeah.
Which is, of course, informed by the myth.
Yeah, I think it's worth looking at, first of all, what do we mean by, you know, fantasy drawing on historical roots? Ultimately, history itself is a narrative.
Yeah.
It may not be a narrative you like very much. You may not have been interested in school. And it may not be a particularly accurate narrative, as we are now discovering.
Yeah. I want to make a little aside here before, as we're going in, and it is relevant. But going into this episode, I want to remind people that everything that we know about history, you know, there are certain scientific things that we can know about history based on, data that we've collected, which can be scientifically tested. But it is actually most of what we know about ancient history is conjecture. And everything else, you know, a lot of our understanding of the way societies ran, of the way that, you know, of people who existed and things like that is all based on written records. And if, you know, with all the cries of fake news nowadays, fake news is not new news, you know, the whole victory was written by the winner. There's a massive, massive point to it. And you do also have to understand that, yeah, our entire judgment of history is based on very, very, very little. And we can hope, we can see some, you know, written records and rely on them to be fact because they've been written in a factual way. But really, we don't know and we can't know. So history is a mystery. Ba-dum-ksh.
Yeah, the best we can do is gather evidence from various different sources and make our best, most informed and most objective case for interpreting those records is ultimately.
And the fact that it is not infallible is proven every day when we find new evidence which corrects our current theories.
Yeah. So anyway, why draw on history as a source of fantasy? And ultimately, there's a really, really good reason for this. First of all, you have to start somewhere with fantasy. And in order to get your readers to do the willing suspension of disbelief, it helps if you have something that's a little bit familiar. I mean, Tolkien, in his essay on fairy stories, talks about secondary belief. If you want readers to invest in what you are trying to sell them fantasy-wise, there must be enough familiarity that they're not so weirded out that they stop reading, is essentially... I mean, obviously he didn't say it like that because Tolkien's we use about 6,000 more words, but, you know... but that is essentially the gist of what he was getting at. And it was a lot more erudite than I've just put it as well, just to be fair to the poor bloke. So there's that. There's also using historical context can add a richness and detail and can assist your world building. So if I was writing something that was set in a world like Renaissance Italy or Venice even, that immediately gives people this sort of context for what the aesthetic is like. Because most people have heard of Venice and know a little bit about the Renaissance. So I don't have to describe the embroidery on every single dress, and I don't have to talk about every single little detail or how they look. You know, I can just pick and choose the ones that really add something to the story. So, you know, there's a good reason for using history as a reference point.
Yeah, and the other and obvious reason for using history is there's actually some pretty interesting stories in history.
Definitely.
And I mean, there's a reason that, putting even the fantasy aside, there's a reason historical fiction is so popular. And putting aside, again, romanticizations of history and things like that, which we've been doing forever. Looking at you, Monmouth. Monmouth? 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 Whatever his name
Monmouth.
Was.
Jeffrey. Monmouth.
Yeah, Jeffrey Monmouth. Ah, Jeffrey. we've been doing it for ages. But history is full of fascinating stories and characters who have become the thing of legends. And it's no wonder then that we are influenced by them. So even if you have people like J.R. Tolkien, what am I talking about? I'm having a small seizure. George R.R. Martin, who's drawing from, you know, not only from the War of the Roses, and I'm sure we'll go into that a little bit more a little bit later, but he's drawing from all these kind of weird and horrific things that actually genuinely happened in history, which are horrific but also very interesting in the same way that the show is.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. But where the whole, you know, rooting something in or basing it off of historical fact falls down is that people then feel that they know what should be coming. And if you give them something that disagrees with their standard narrative, you get accused of, that's not historically accurate. Never mind that you're writing fantasy. And emphasis is on fantasy.
Fantasy, yeah.
People can handle dragons and, you know, the Walking Dead, but apparently they can't handle the fact that, you know, maybe not everybody got raped all the time.
Yeah, no, for example. It was... I will never forget an editor's comment on The Sons of Thespian, where you had a same-sex marriage going on in the background, and someone said, is this historically accurate? And I went, one of my characters can turn into a giant winged cat. I'm not really concerned about historical accuracy. Second of all, this is not happening in any historical period ever.
Or
Earth,
even in this world.
Even in this world. Finally, actually, yeah. We have records of same-sex marriage going back. So seriously.
Get a grip.
Yeah. And I know this person wasn't coming from a place of bigotry either. They weren't saying... It was a genuine concern of, oh, this will really jar people. And I think that there's an element of truth to that as well. And stepping aside from the way that we portray, you know, sexuality and things like that, because that's a whole other kettle of fish and we're going to go into it. Language. If you're writing a fantasy story, which is set in this kind of middle age sort of world, even if it's nothing like Earth, if you have people running around saying, yeah, cool, okay, it's immediately jarring.
Yeah, you've got to be a bit careful. And again, it's the whole secondary belief thing that Tolkien was talking about.
Yeah.
You have to be careful in how you present things. But that is no excuse for writing the same stories that everybody else has written before you, using the same cast of very white, very male, cishet characters that everybody else has written, and setting them in the same Eurocentric fantasy worlds. There's no excuse. That's just lazy. It's easier, but it's lazy.
Yeah.
And it's also incorrect, factually.
Yes.
The problem with the it's not historically accurate argument is that that means people are using historical accuracy to prop up this reign of misogyny, racism, and homophobia inside a fantasy context. And once you start doing that, you're on very, very dangerous ground, because we've talked about art reflecting life.
Mm-hmm.
At a certain point, when a certain amount of art has been made and everybody's talking about it, then life starts reflecting art as well, and it becomes something of a loop.
Yeah. And not only that, when you see things like that, when you see history or historical kind of worlds which represent men as, you know, all being low-key rapists.
Yep.
What's actually happening is that you are conditioning and supporting this idea that that is the base male level of instinct.
Yeah.
That the only thing that is stopping men doing that right now is the fact that we're in a more advanced society. And that's simply not true. And we know it's not true for a number of reasons. But when we allow that kind of narrative, and people say, well, but, you know, we understand the difference between fiction and reality. But I would argue you don't. Remember, the only narrative about history that we experience, that we really see, all comes from very carefully put together media. And we have no idea what Roman Britain actually looked like. We have no idea what the Roman Empire looked like, except based on records and things like that. And the Romans were actually pretty good with records. And we do have a lot of archaeological evidence. But in terms of visualizing it, all of our visualizations will come from things like Gladiator or, you know, Rome or things like that, these TV shows,
yeah,
which are ingrained in our head. And even if we say, okay, I recognize those are fiction, that image, because it's the only real visual that we have, is going to remain. And it will affect the way you do it unless you stop and examine it critically.
Yeah, definitely. And not everybody has got either the nounce, the time, or, you know, the will,
the desire.
The desire is a good one. To actually delve in and question everything. Mm. Obviously, everybody should, but you don't have to do reams of research. Actually, a lot of this shit is quite easy to find out for yourself. You don't have to go that far.
Yeah. I can also understand, you know, you'd say, oh, but, you know, you've had all these researchers who are behind a film. they will have depicted it as accurately as possible. When the reality is, even though they say research team, what usually happens is the research team says this, and the director goes, nah, that's not that great. I'm going to do it this way.
Yeah.
And the research team just,
Yeah, definitely. And you need somebody who has the vision and, again, the desire to portray something in an accurate way that still will sell a film or book or other product.
Yeah.
So, anyway, let's debunk some of the myths. And I think a good one to start with, if we just start with women and then we can work our way in as they get more insidious.
Hooray! Yeah, okay, let's start with the obvious one. About women and their role in history.
Yeah, women and their role in history. Now, you would be, if you just picked up a random A-level textbook, or whatever the American equivalent is, you might be forgiven for thinking that the only woman of note in history were people like Elizabeth I over here, or Marie Curie, and that was it, and there was literally nobody in between.
Yeah.
And that women were never doing anything interesting in history. They were just being done to. They were baby factories or dying of childbirth, and that was pretty much it.
Yeah.
Occasionally they did a bit of sewing. But in actuality, everything, anything and everything job-wise that men did, women also did. And I do literally mean anything. Pick a career, anything from, you know, tanning hides to, I don't know, riding into battle, and do some research on it. I guarantee there will be women there. They may have disguised themselves as men, but they went. They were there doing it. Quite often, they weren't disguised at all. They were just written out because it didn't fit a certain narrative.
Yeah. I think another thing to recognise is that, yes, historically, there have been some atrocious examples of sexism. And Greece, for instance, ancient Greece, incredibly sexist society. Women had almost no rights, unless, of course, you were in Sparta. Spartan women had a great time of it, you know. In comparison, they were still in Sparta. But regardless, Roman women, if you were high born, you would have a lot more freedom and liberty and things like that, but only if you were high born. And the reason the Romans were so fascinated with Celtic and British women was because they were actually, as far as the Romans were concerned, they were a lot more boisterous, they were a lot more open, because there was much more of an equal society. Similarly, you look over at the Vikings, there were some amazing traditions within the Vikings. But divorce, for instance, a woman was in charge of the money and the house, and she could kick you out. You know, she was in charge of land as well. Their roles were not limited to just the homemaker. And in fact, more important is this underestimate, even if they were homemakers within history, the importance of that role has actually changed. And that, you know, back in the Viking times, being the homemaker meant being in charge of the farm, being in charge of all of the money coming in, being able to kick your husband to the curb if he offended you in any way, and being able to divorce him pretty much at the drop of a hat. Okay, men were literally expendable in that way.
Let's point out that was a tradition that continued in Ireland right up until the sort of 17th century.
Good job, so, Ireland.
Very, very similar outlook in that respect. And yeah, women weren't really supposed to ride off into battle or join the navy or anything like that. But you know, that particular type of Irish law was still in force.
Yeah.
So and that's merely the tip of the iceberg. So when we say, let's look at the whole warrior woman concept, which, you know, back in sort of, I think it was around the late 70s, someone had this genius idea and fantasy of what if one of the main characters was a woman and she gets a sword. I know swords are for men because men are soldiers, therefore, you know, they get the swords and women get to be princesses. But what if one of them was actually a warrior? And, you know, we'll make her sexually attractive and she'll be really, really
good. She'll be a sexy warrior.
But we won't give her much of a character. And it became a trope in its own right. And the thing was, they didn't have a clue that pretty much any battle in history, women were there. And women were not just there as washerwomen and prostitutes. Women were there fighting. Sometimes they weren't on the front line, but a lot of the times they were. Battle of Hastings, a fair number of the feared were actually women who had just gone into battle. They called up the able body. They weren't that fussed about gender. These are not the exceptions that prove the rule. So you have Shaka Zulu. Shaka Zulu had an entire battalion he had all female regiments. And they weren't sort of like his 1,200 concubines in his harem, which is, you know, what a shallow reading of historical texts will tell you. A lot of them were warriors, part of the army. They just formed all-female battalions, and they were absolutely ferocious and terrifying. Of the Vikings that from digging up graves over here, because, you know, they were buried with swords, so therefore they must be men, obviously. When they finally got the idea to test the bones, the DNA, they found that nearly 60% of them were women. So 60% of those who went overseas trying to get new land to farm, and, you know, okay, obviously slaving and murdering and burning churches, but about 60% of them were women. Then add to that, you think of places like feudal Japan, which was incredibly sexist in some respects. But again, women were still breaking out. You had all women armies of the Onabugesha, and that went on for hundreds of years. I think the trouble is we're sold a narrative whereby a select 100 or 200 years is taken to mean all of history, and it's simply not true. So you might have 100 or 200 years whereby a more oppressive regime is in place, but before that, yes, there were women in the army, there were female samurais. They were holding land, and they were voting, and they were getting involved in politics, and they were riding off to war, and they were starting rebellions, and they were chopping heads off. You know, this isn't a case of, oh, well, I'm like Joan of Arc, I've been touched by God, I must do this thing. There were women in the armies. Every army there's ever been, there's been women in it.
And
there's been transgender people in it too, and gay people.
Yes.
We'll get onto that afterwards, but I'm just making the point, the one thing where I can possibly think of where maybe they didn't have women, and I could be wrong, was when we first started using submarines, because it would have been quite difficult to sneak on board a submarine and then live for months on a submarine as a disguised man. But then again, I could be wrong. Because part of the problem with riding into battle as dressed as a man, for example, and that's certainly not what all women did, but some of them did, or some of them happened to think, you know what, maybe not wearing skirts, maybe wearing breeches or something would be better for riding a horse. And they weren't even disguised, but they got misgendered and erased and written out of historical texts. So I would question whether that any women managed to get onto submarines to serve that way, but I could be wrong, because I've been wrong in so many ways on various other historical fronts. And I suppose that's the problem, because what was sold to me by my history teacher at school was that women stayed home and had babies.
Yeah. And I, not only is that incredibly damaging for a number of reasons, in terms of storycraft, it's basically caused generations of literature to come out which have belittled and erased the importance of and the contributions that women have made in history, and have even taken that a step further by saying, look, historically women have been useless, but they're so useless that even in fantasy fiction, even in a fictitious world, they continue to be useless. A fictitious world where anything else is possible, where dragons and ghosts and goblins and demons, all of that is possible, but a woman possibly contributing to any of the decisions that have been made, not possible at all.
Yeah, it's like we'll accept that we have a shape-shifting winged cat, or that we have Walking Dead, an army of them marching on a great ice wall, but the idea that women might actually fight, or that they might wield political power, or that they were educated. This is a big one, that women weren't worth educating and nobody bothered, and that is utter bollocks. It is absolute crap. We don't know how much was actually destroyed, but we can be pretty sure that women were educated. You know, even in ancient Greece, women were educated.
Yeah.
And let's
depending.
It depends, but my point is that you can keep selling this narrative that women didn't do anything historically, but they did an awful lot of things, and some of it was they just got forgotten and people wrote them out and they erased them, and some of it was deliberate. Some of it was a very deliberate, no, we're going to burn what you've written, we're going to hide that, we can't sell that to the next generation, the world is going in this direction.
Yeah, and some of this forgetting that we've done has actually been incredibly recent as well.
Yes.
It's not just alt people back then going, no, no, we can't possibly allow a woman into the narrative. It's that women were in the narrative and they've just been forgotten in the way that we study texts now in the resources that we come from. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, that any subject you learn at school is going to be limited. And it's only if you really, really go on to do, you know, history at a much higher level that you are going to actually learn the truth of a lot of people who education has basically decided they are not the most important people to bring into this narrative.
Yeah, and unless you absolutely can't have the narrative without them, I think. I mean, people forget that we've actually had three Queen Elizabeths now.
Yep.
But we don't count one of them because they don't believe her contribution was actually significant enough. You can argue that or not. And then you forget about the fact that that Scottish kings were crowned by a specific family of the House of Buchanan in Fife, and that the women would rebel as strongly against the English as the men did. In fact, sometimes the women were the only ones left alive, and so they would crown the Scottish kings. I'm thinking of Isabella, Countess of Buchan, for example, who, you know, had some pretty shitty stuff happened to her after that, but I won't go into it. So it's not a case of she was led astray either, or any of them were led astray. It was a case of, no, I can see this. I'm a self-directing creature and I will make my own decisions. It was just slightly more difficult to do if you were female, but it certainly happened. So, okay, that's women, and one way it's used lazily in fantasy is to, you know, either go to one extreme and have just the fantasy warrior woman, which is actually quite as damaging, to be honest, because what you're saying there is, well, this character's an exception. So unless you're going to people your narrative with other female warriors, then what you're saying is this is an exception you cannot aspire to.
Yeah.
Or they go the other way, and it's a case of, if it's a woman, then she must be fighting only for a child, or she's not fighting, or, you know, she has to suffer something traumatic, therefore she must be raped, or I need some tension in this scene, so I'll throw in a romance.
Yeah, or it's she's doing it because she's got something to prove.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that it becomes inherently sexual as well.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that is one of the things that, without going into any spoilers, one of the things people probably object to with the most recent Captain Marvel film was the fact that it's no spoiler to say there is no love interest.
No, there isn't. I thought there might be, and then there really was.
Yeah. But the thing was, we are conditioned to think there might be, and it worked just as well without there being one.
Mm.
You don't need to have a love interest just because your main character's female.
Yeah.
You don't need to have that to add dimensions to her character and say there's softness and gentleness there as well. So she is accessible even though she is this awesome warrior.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. So that is really lazy writing to just say there must be one, because I can't think of any other way to do it.
Yeah, and I would say with Captain Marvel, the way that they did want to add the softness, because they wanted to add the human side to her, which was important.
Yeah.
But I loved the way they did it. They did it with her best friend and a cat.
Exactly. And it was perfect. So there are lots of ways. You know, if you need tension in a scene between a man and a woman, it doesn't have to be sexual tension.
Yeah.
I think, actually, The Expanse, which is a series that is now on Amazon Prime, although you can see the first two series on Netflix, does an amazing job of having women in important roles without it being obvious. They're not clubbing you over the head and saying this is our political statement.
Yeah.
They're there because they are the best person for that job.
Yeah.
And they interact with men, and it's that everybody's kind of like, they're equal characters within a scene. They're not being threatened with rape just because they're women.
Yeah.
Which kind of brings us on to rape, I think, as a fantasy trope.
There is no denying that rape is definitely something which has happened historically. It is something which continues to happen now. Rape was treated, depending which culture, depending who was doing it, depending, you know, invasions and things like that. It wasn't as, I don't think it's unfair to say, it wasn't as rampant as a lot of historical fiction likes to present. Now, there were certainly cases where there was a lot of abuses of power happening. Certain war crimes, and acts against humanity where soldiers would invade, and that would be part of it. But it wasn't actually that common, particularly within inter-societies, you know, internal societies. If there was no invading force, it wasn't actually that common. Yeah. Mostly because actually it would have been, in a lot of societies, it would have been punished in an incredibly severe way.
Yeah, I mean, let's just unpack that a little bit. Let's look at the fact that, okay, rape is used as a tool of war. There are, and have been, and probably will be, unfortunately, people who command armies who say anything you do once you get in there is a perk, and that will appeal to a certain percentage.
Yeah.
And that's unfortunate, but that is how it's used to... It's a good way in that respect of oppressing a particular population once you've taken them over.
Yeah.
Let's just be clear here, though. A lot of men get raped in those situations too. It's not just women.
Yes.
Sometimes it doesn't matter who. It's a case of, excuse the barbarism, but it's a case of any hole's a goal at that point. It could be anything. It could be a hole in the ground. They are so keyed up that they will just... It's a power play. I mean, rape always is a power play, but rape as a tool of war is very much a power play.
Mm.
And it's not a case of, oh, well, are you over 18? Are you over 16? Are you the right gender? It's a case of, no, you're the enemy, and I must suppress the enemy.
Yeah.
That doesn't make it any less disgusting, but let's start from a broad basis of understanding what it means.
Yes.
Now, within a society, yes, abuses of power happen. And they still happen now, and you can still get attacked on the street. You can get attacked if you're a man on the street, by the way, as well,
mm-hmm.
with a sexual goal in mind. Mostly it's women, and part of the reason it's mostly women, I can't help but feel, is because we are portrayed this over and over and over again in media, as well as, you know, tales passed down from one person to the other. And we've come to expect it to be part of female life.
Mm-hmm.
So thus is the power of fiction and the power of language. This is why when you have rape survivors, they will call themselves survivors, not victims. Mm. And it does piss me off when people insist on asserting victim over and over again. Language is really important. It changes how we view ourselves.
Yeah.
That aside, Madeline's absolutely right. The Celts, there's records of them staking out rapists and paedophiles on high wooden platforms by nailing through their wrists and ankles, stripping them naked and leaving them for the crows. And in that situation, generally it took days to die.
Mm.
It was a horrible death. The punishment for a confirmed rape was actually death.
Yeah.
And then there are other societies as well who punish rapists in the same way. You'll notice I'm saying rapists and not actually just male rapists.
No.
Because this is something that, while it has typically been men, it can also be other genders as well.
Yeah. Something else also worth pointing out, because I know someone out there will be thinking this. Yes, there have absolutely been cultures where actually... rape has not been pursued, or I say pursued, as in a rapist has not been pursued or prosecuted, and where actually the survivor of a rape could themselves find themselves imprisoned. It still happens in certain societies today. I know, I've lived in some of those societies. And it is frightening, and that did happen historically too. So we're absolutely not saying that there weren't some horrific atrocities which were committed back then. And we're not saying that rape in historical fiction is inaccurate, because it isn't. It is an abuse which has occurred throughout history in the same way that murder has occurred throughout history, in the same way that child abuse has occurred throughout history. We're simply saying that actually the way that it is portrayed in fantastical fiction, which is drawing on that historic fact, is actually, it's more fiction than it is fact, more often than not. And actually the real problem is that it has been a tool which has been drawn on so often that it is now being mistaken for fact, to the point that it is no longer about having a story which includes rape. It's that you cannot have a big fantasy fiction without including rape. And in particular, that the rape which they have decided to portray, and in particular visual fantasy, so things like TV shows and films, are terrible with this. It's almost always a beautiful young girl who's being raped.
That's one of the worst things about the Game of Thrones TV series, which, you know, I really enjoy that. But they've increased the levels of rape in the TV series by, I don't know, about 20-25% easily. And it's noticeable that when you have a character who's being sexually abused, 90% of the time it's a woman, and she's young and nubile and attractive to look at, and the perspective of the camera as it's happening is not through, you know, the victim's eyes. It's through the eyes of someone either watching it externally, or you kind of are being asked to be complicit with the rapist. You're being asked in art to agree with what's going on, because this is what everybody knows. This is historically accurate.
And they say, you know, we want you to see it so that it's shocking. To be honest, I actually think that if you saw it from the survivor's point of view, it would actually be even worse to have someone looming over you. I mean, obviously it depends on certain things, but I do think it's very particular that whenever you see scenes like this, okay, first of all, almost always they expose the breasts, which I would argue would probably not always happen. Is there time? Probably not. So that's a sexual thing. That's about, and I say that's a sexual thing for the audience. You know, this is a decision which has been made to make, to give the attack a sexual component. The woman is almost always wonderfully, fantastically shaved.
Yeah.
And that's the bit that always gets me, because I always think, why aren't they hairy? Why haven't they got hair in their armpits and between their legs, and down their legs as well? People will be like, oh, you know, that wouldn't look very nice. It doesn't. Well, exactly. It's not supposed to look nice. You're attacking these young girls who haven't been wedded yet. You've decided to extend the fiction of the society that all of these women were either waxing or shaving, which is ludicrous already. So where's the historical accuracy of that? You know, and they're perfectly nubile and they're perfectly good looking. And the angle is such that, you know,
it's filmed for titillation. It's not filmed to shock. I don't care what they say.
Yeah, it is. And it's, as you say, there is a level of titillation involved in everything that's done. It's not portrayed as horror. It's not portrayed as an attack. It's this connection between rape being something which is inherently sexual
rather than violence. If you think about it, if we were watching somebody getting eviscerated or whatever, we tend to get that from the person who is being eviscerated's point of view, or at least we get an omniscient third person point of view if it's being filmed.
Yeah.
We're not asked to be complicit in it in the same way we are with rape. We know it. I suppose the issue with historically is that it's not a case of, oh, it's only recently become a crime. Mm. In some instances, for example, marital rape was only really became something you could prosecute for in the 1970s, I think it was. Mm-hmm. It might have even been later than that.
Yeah.
And it was always difficult to get a conviction. But to suggest that we haven't always known it was wrong is utter rubbish. It's complete bullshit. Because we have. There's been punishments for it throughout history. It was always very difficult to get a conviction. But to suggest that it was a case of, no, this was just what happened and people thought it was okay. Utter crap. We don't really have time to go into a lot of the historical sexism that goes with it. I suggest we go on to us queer folk instead.
Yes. So putting, yeah, and actually kind of leading on to that, just very quickly, with gender, as we mentioned, with the whole assault and rape thing, a lot of people who were being raped there would have been a lot of men being raped, particularly in military situations as well. And in prisons, because it was meant as a violent act. Moving on to that, again, we come into some of the most vulnerable minorities in society, and that is queer people. So homosexuals, transgender, asexuals as well. Weirdly enough, they all existed in history.
Yeah, I mean, and they've existed for more than the last sort of 100, 200 years. There have been transgender people all the way back to when we were living in caves.
Yes.
I'm sure this will come as a big shock to some people. There have also been gay people since then, too.
Yes. And when people say, well, no, this is all a very recent phenomenon, it isn't. And it's not just conjecture either. We do have written evidence of this genuinely, truly happening. We have transgender emperors in the Roman Empire when it split up into several empires. It got very confusing. they are across the world. And I think the other problem is that we say historical accuracy based on a very, very tiny, tiny, tiny period of history.
Yeah.
We're always just like, the Tudors!
because nothing happened before then, yeah. And nothing happened after that.
Yeah, and also, very importantly, we say nothing happened before then, nothing happened after them, and nothing was happening anywhere else. And that this one particular area, you know, we'll say Europe. Let's be generous and just say Europe. Europe was the only culture that there possibly ever was, and everyone else was doing exactly the same thing. And of course, we know that's complete bollocks. And the Christians have got a lot to answer for in this case. Because across the world, in lots and lots of different places, same-sex marriage was a thing. You see it in Native American peoples. You see it in ancient Japan. Okay? It was in lots and lots of different places. You even see it in British history itself and in Celtic history. Okay, even when the church was established, there have been records of same-sex marriage. So it was happening throughout history. And it was just this one particular kind of religion which kind of roped off into the Abrahamic religions, which all got together and went, no!
Yeah,
not allow.
I'm gonna chip in there because I've actually been researching the 14th century recently, and I stumbled across something that made me go, "Oh my god!" You know. First of all, and I did know this, right up into the 14th, 15th century, monks and priests could still marry legally.
Yeah.
So there's that. So let's start from a position of understanding that you weren't expected to take a vow of chastity, if you're a man at least, if you took holy orders. What really got me was the fact that we had church-sanctioned gay marriage during the 14th century, as in it would be blessed by a priest, and it was a legal institution. Now, to be absolutely clear about this, it was called a frèrement, which basically means, roughly translated, that you were embracing somebody as your brother, and it tended to be between two men. And it didn't have to be a carnal marriage. Sometimes, in the case of two men who were, you know, they could have been brothers in arms, or they could have been two actual literal blood brothers.
Yeah.
What they would do, instead of necessarily marrying a woman, they would they would form this almost like a civil partnership together, and they would share all their goods. So if one of them died, the other person inherited what was left.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, it wasn't incestuous and carnal if it was two actual blood brothers together.
Yeah.
It was just that was the legal institution whereby they could say, no, we have this connection, I'm their next of kin. So it was a legal loophole. But it was actually officially recognised, and it was recognised and blessed by the church. A lot of those affrayments were, and we have records of this, written records, the Vatican has most of them, strangely enough, whereby it was a carnal relationship. These were two people who, you know, we assume they were in love if they went against popular opinion like that, who formed what was basically a same-sex marriage. In fact, it was a same-sex marriage, it was just called something slightly different. Marriages were different in the 14th century. You didn't get married inside the church, for a start.
Yeah.
In fact, a church might not have been involved. You didn't have to have a priest officiate. It was desirable, but not necessary. You might sleep with each other and then decide a week later that you were married. And that was considered a civil, you know, that was considered a common law marriage. And that was it for life. You didn't have to exchange rings or anything like that. It was a lot looser. You just needed two people to say, yes, we are married. And that was it. You were married.
Mm.
So while they did have weddings, that was a big production that came much, much later. And it tended to be more of a noble thing. But to actually go the extra mile and get your relationship with someone officially, legally recognised and usually officiated over by a priest, so it was blessed and a sanctioned union, that sounds like gay marriage to me.
It certainly does.
And it's not the only example. I've spoken before about amongst seamen and pirates, matelage, whereby you formed a common law marriage with another sailor and they would inherit your possessions upon your death and vice versa. Once again, common law marriage, and it was accepted.
Yeah.
So it's not a case of, it just makes my head spin a bit when we get now and people get their knickers in a twist about same-sex marriage, and it's a case of, we've been doing this for centuries, guys, literally centuries.
Yeah.
And you know what? The church was in on it. The church didn't give a shit as long as you paid your tithes.
Yeah. Again, we have to emphasise how much of the misconceptions we have about history are very recent phenomenon. Incredibly recent. And just to give you a perspective, and this is actually about American history, you know all those Confederate statues?
Yeah.
My understanding, and I may be wrong, so if anyone knows a little bit better or has researched the subject, do feel free to contact us. But my understanding is that they were actually all created pretty much around the same time. And the reason that they're so easy to destroy is because they're actually quite cheaply made. Because there was this kind of this mass production and they were just all put around everywhere. And it was all kind of, you know, they've been made out to be these big historical pieces, but they're not. They're actually quite modern, and they all came out at around the same time. And it is propaganda, really.
Yeah.
So it's just an example of the fact that a narrative is being controlled.
Yeah, and we're not suggesting that there's a secret cabal of moustache twirling white men somewhere. Who are saying
there is clearly a secret cabal of.
Well, that's just it. I don't think anybody's talking to anyone else about this. This is just a case of what can I give them that they will actually buy? Which is the sad thing, because we're doing that with history and have been doing it for centuries. And now we're doing it with fantasy, and that's even worse.
Yeah.
Because fantasy is the lens that you look through when you want to challenge the preconceptions of history. So if we are adding those preconceptions in, then we are really fucking ourselves.
Yeah.
Can we have a quick discussion of race? Because I realise we're running out of time, but we've hit most of the big tropes. There are others, obviously. But let's examine this idea that Europe was white right up until sort of 1700.
Okay. So I did actually see a great thing, which was the BBC, portraying Rome. And someone had gone, oh, well, you know, good job, BBC, with all the representation, even if it is historically inaccurate to have black men in England during the Roman era. And here's the thing, right? And I'm going to start with Rome, because Rome's where it's at, right? Rome, the Romans, they were this massive empire, which, a little bit like, you know, the British, a little bit later on, they conquered quite a fair bit. And the way they conquered was actually quite smart. They sort of assimilated cultures. They kind of just swallowed them up and went, not now you're, they said, now you're Roman, but you can also still be you. And it's why the Roman Empire worked as successfully as it did for as long as it did.
Yeah, they were like the Borg.
They were, they were the Borg. Is that what the Borg are based on, John?
I don't know, I'm just having that same thought, possibly.
Are they space Romans? Oh my god! So the Borg, or the Romans, would go in and they'd assimilate all of these people, and then everyone, you know, was Roman. You were Roman, that was it. You were a Roman citizen, you could be part of the Roman Empire. And so they had a lot, and this is archaeologically confirmed as well. We found remains, okay? Also, once again, Romans were actually pretty good at keeping records. And these are the kinds of records you were probably pretty unlikely to fabricate. I mean, again, possibility, they could have gone, ha, 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 we're all white, but let's pretend we're not. Don't know why, but they could have. but we know for a fact that they had Syrians with them. They would have had people from several of the African countries, across the African continent, they would have brought over as well. They had people from all over, and all of them were in the army. And we know for a fact that we at least had Syrians up on Hadrian's Wall.
Yeah, definitely.
We know this. So the Roman Empire was massively multicultural, which meant everywhere that the Romans invaded also became massively multicultural.
Yeah, and it's not just, I mean, the Romans are a brilliant example, and then there's obviously the Moorish invasion, whereby Moor used to be kind of a catch-all term for anyone with a significantly darker skin, melanin content, in the Middle Ages. So, you know, you could be from Libya or Syria or much, much further. And there are obviously Jews trading all across Europe as well. And I know that China had more or less closed its borders to the rest of the world right up until sort of the 1800s, but there were still people from, you know, Southeast Asia as well, also making the journey. So, you know, humans do not stay put in one place.
Yeah.
And then when we get together, we all sort of breed like rabbits. You know, I mean, part of that is biological drive, because, you know, a diverse gene pool is a healthy gene pool. Mm-hmm. But as an example, I can't remember the exact statistics. Go away and check it for yourself if you're interested. But they did a large pool of testing of DNA of Irish people recently. And I think it was something like around 20% of them carry DNA from places like Africa. 40% carry DNA from places like Greece. 60% carry DNA from places like Spain. And what was really fascinating was the fact that this actually kind of supports the Leva-Gavla Erin, which is the book of the taking of Ireland, where you have various waves of people coming across and settling Ireland, and they come from all over the place. It's a case of, oh my god, this is amazing.
I do, the mythological cycle where basically everyone is invading Ireland one after the other. The Fomori are there, and then the Tuatha De Danann come from, perhaps they were Danish, perhaps they were Viking, perhaps they came from the sky, who knows. But they arrive, and then the Milesians arrive, and before that, there were several other invasions. But yeah, weirdly enough, there were a lot of people arriving on this tiny little island.
Yeah, it's a largely, even still, it's a, you know, in most places, particularly the rural areas, it's largely a white country. But most of those white people contain DNA from various other places.
Yes. And again, It's very, very recent. This phenomenon is quite recent, of this segregation. And yeah, for the most part, Britain in particular, and Ireland very much in particular, does have a larger white population rather than people of colour. But as you say, historically, people of colour have existed there and have continued to and continue to exist there.
Yeah, to say...
To
basically populate your Eurocentric fantasy novel with only white people is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Unless you can explain to me, unless you're writing some sort of high sci-fi whereby it's a very specific planet and it's literally only just contacted the rest of the universe and everybody shares a genetic phenotype that's very similar for particular ecological and genetic reasons. Mm-hmm. I might buy it then, but I'm not going to buy it any other way.
Yes, indeed.
I just want to mention, because I mentioned one of her blogs at the beginning, Samantha Shannon and The Priory of the Orange Tree, which is an absolute delight to read, and I've recommended it before. It's Eastern Dragons and Western Dragons and queens and queendoms and queer relationships. And yeah, there is a heterosexual relationship, but you know, it's kind of behind closed doors and relegated to longing looks and sighing for each other. And it's just so beautifully done because the real relationships are all queer ones. And yes, she's clearly drawn significantly on various periods of history. So the world building is amazing and it's got lots of depth and everything, but it challenges all those fantasy tropes that we've been talking about today. So I really recommend it. It is about 850 pages.
Be prepared.
Be prepared. But it's well worth it. It's a really good book.
Yeah.
So some people are getting it right. Let's get more people writing books like that.
Yeah. I think it ends for me in the one that I always get really, really pissed off about. And actually they touched on it really well in an episode of Psych. Which is a comedy about a guy pretending to be a psychic. It's hilarious. You know, it's quite old now, but I really did enjoy it. And he's got his best friend Gus, who's a black man. And at one point they're investigating this theater production who are doing they're doing a performance about Jack the Ripper. Yeah. And Gus wants to audition for the play, and he's like, I'd like to be the inspector. I can be a Jamaican inspector. And they were like, okay, but you know, this is set in Victorian England. And he went, so what are you saying? Black people haven't been invented yet? And I was like, oh, good line. And even then I thought, yeah, but I guess they have a point. I can understand why they'd. And then I stopped and I literally stopped myself and went, hold on a second. Victorian Britain. Victorian London, right? Okay. Not just the capital of England, all right? Not just the capital of England, the capital of the empire, which was half of the whole world, okay? That's insane. There were people coming in from all over. London was a multicultural base and has remained so to this day. We had people from all over the world, and I was going, is it really realistic to have a black man starring in a play about Jack the Ripper, which is also a musical? Like, I really had to stop myself and go, that's the dumbest white person thing I've ever thought.
And that's essentially what Madeline and I are getting at with this episode. Challenge your preconceptions when you read a fantasy. In fact, challenge your preconceptions, full stop. But especially yeah. If you're presented with a white Eurocentric fantasy novel that does not feature any queer characters, any transgender characters, any women doing interesting things, any black characters or Asian characters, you might want to sort of think about it.
Yeah. And also, just as an aside with that, something which I think is important to note is that sometimes people will include characters from other cultures. Or people of colour within their books. But what they do is that they create them as an outside force. And that's okay. You can have that, right, okay, so they represent such and such culture. They are separate, different from us. They have more savage rules, or perhaps they are more sophisticated, you know, and it creates this othering.
Yeah.
And that's okay. You want to do that. You want to say that's fine. But I think if the Romans have taught us anything, and that the same thing that happened, again, in Victorian Britain, is that within cultures, you can have people of different color who are still part of that culture. You could, you could have a Syrian or a black man, or a Gaul who were all part of the Roman Empire. Not sure about the Gaul being part of the Roman Empire, but you know what I mean. Or a Gaul, all being part of the Roman Empire, and they were all Roman. Okay. They each had different backgrounds. They each came from very different parts of the world, but they were all Roman. Same in, you know, Victorian society. You could have a soldier who came all the way from India. You could have someone who came from China, or maybe not from China, but from India or from the West Indies.
Well, no, you would have had China. Think about the huge opium trade.
Yeah, exactly. But the thing I'm saying in particular, British colonies, and these people, you know, they were part of Britain. They were British, and this continued on, you know, until the war. And you had a lot of people coming from the West Indies who were saying, yeah, we have come to fight for Britain because we are British. And they were raised British. And yes, they would have had their own culture as well, but they were still part of the big culture. So if you are writing, or when you are reading, consider that as well. Consider, do I need to create this narrative of us and them? Does it need to be different? Or can they all be part of the same society? Because even within the same society, you know, we can have different cultures. White people can have different cultures. I've had a very different upbringing to someone who was raised in Scotland on a farm. Okay? Those are different cultures. And yet we can both recognise we're part of the United Kingdom.
Yeah.
Basically, so something to consider.
Basically, historical accuracy does not mean a white, cis, heteronormative past.
Yes. So consider what is fact. And actually, yeah, do put a little bit of research into it. And when someone turns around and says, well, that's just the way that it was in history, be prepared to question that, because there is no one set of rules which happened in history. And even if it is the way that it was in history, you're writing fiction, mate.
Exactly. You get the chance to unmake certain bits. Anyway, we could go on and on, but I think we better go on to our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And it's one we both recommend, but I think, do you want to take it, Madeline?
I will take it. So we'd like to recommend Captain Marvel, which by the time this airs, it will have been out for a little while. But
yeah.
I think we both went and saw it on its opening day.
We practically went at the same time.
We did, we did.
You're like, messaging, I've just seen Captain Marvel. And you went, yeah, so have I. Like,
I literally just went, hey, it's on tomorrow. And again, this sounds like we're dating and we've gone together. We didn't. I think
we were in different counties.
But yeah, really, really enjoyed. For me, it took me a while to get into it to begin with, because I thought, oh God, where are we going with this? And then it took an unexpected turn, which I really liked, and it was enjoyable. I do highly recommend it. I think in terms of, you know, Marvel movies, this is another success.
Yeah, so. Definitely.
And on that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.